Your child deserves an education that sets them up for success. K-12 knows that learning isn't one size fits all and has options tailored to each child's needs, interests, and goals for the future. K-12 powered schools are tuition-free, accredited online public schools for students in kindergarten through 12th grade. Students learn at their speed, at home, from state-certified teachers specially trained to teach online. Join the more than 3 million families who've chosen K-12. Go to k12.com/podcast to enroll today.
Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 89, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
And me, Ravi Abbott.
And I can't believe this, for the second week running, we're recording this show early in the morning on the weekend.
On a Sunday, Dan, we're up on a Sunday.
I didn't know there was two 10 o'clocks in a Sunday. Not normally awake this early.
No, I'm used to being up late, you know, being a sound engineer. I'm never up on the Sunday. I'm in the shadows, in the dark at 4 a.m.
You're normally crawling in from some sleazy party right about now, aren't you? But the reason we're doing it is just because, I mean, the next couple of weeks are going to be so manic. I mean, you know, even forgetting the fact that I'm getting married in, you know, 2 weeks today.
Yeah.
That's like, you know, the least important thing right now. Obviously, next week, we're going to be in London for the this really exciting Guardian talk. They're going to be doing Sega Mega Drive versus SNES.
Oh, with Violet Berlin. Oh, it's going to be great. Can't wait.
You're finally going to get to meet Violet Berlin, Revy.
Yeah, and also shout stuff at Nintendo fans. It should be good.
Well, that's going to be coming up on Thursday night at the Guardian HQ in London, so we're going to be going down for that. If there are some tickets left, we'll put a link on our website. And then, speaking of massive events, this is, can't believe it's only like less than a month away now, we are proud to announce that we are once again going to be hosting the talk stage at Play Expo. Now, this time, it's the big one in Manchester.
I'll just try and set the picture for you. It's outside the Trafford Centre, which is giant itself. Big central shopping centre in Manchester. And then it's like this kind of giant aircraft hangar, basically.
It's massive. Event City, it's called, isn't
it? Yeah. And it is a city. It's full of kind of games, cosplay people, arcade units, even cars. You know, they had the Transformer cars drove in there last time.
But, I mean, you know, we've been going, this will be our third year that we've gone. And it is, when you walk in there, it is like a geek's paradise, isn't it? You walk in, it's like, whoa.
I remember when we first went, you know, both of us, we were just like, oh my God. We didn't believe that there was an event in the UK that would be this big for gaming, you know.
Because we've been to a couple before, like small ones held in like little village hall and that kind of thing, but
it's just mind blown when you go in there, totally.
When you walk in there and there's, you know, loads of different sections, so usually the stage that we're going to be hosting on is when you first walk in. You'll see that straight away.
Yeah.
Loads of chairs all laid out. Proper stage. You know, it's like doing a rock concert, isn't it, when you're in there? And then all the traders are in the middle. And this is the area where you can come along. And, I mean, we're talking prices at these events. Always way better than eBay.
But you could buy loads of stuff. There's like all the kind of memorable stuff, memorabilia, and then there's like weapons. There's like, you know, kind of the rarest games. There's loads of art created around it, and it's really nice, actually. And then there's a whole retro section as well. So there's kind of the new companies representing stuff as well. They had Team 17 there last time, Cinemaware, all of those guys.
And there's always like an old obscure computer section as well in the middle with, like, you know, these systems that you've never heard of or you've never used for years.
Yeah, some really odd stuff.
And, of course, one of the main attractions of the event, the free-to-play arcades.
Well, we always go with our friends, don't we? Yeah. Like Joe, Richard, Alex, and as soon as they go near the arcades, they seem to just get absorbed.
We lose them.
They're just gone into these machines. Can't find them for the rest of the event, you know.
I think, Alex and Joe were playing Point Blank last year, weren't they?
Yeah. And they were House of the Dead as well,
They're playing it, then they're coming off it, queuing again for it, playing it, coming off it, queuing again for it. So, I mean, that in itself, if you put, you know, if you went to an arcade and put a quid into each one of these machines, the ticket price itself covers that, So we're going to be down there hosting a few of the talks. We're going to be hanging around all weekend. I think the headline one for us is going to be, oh my God, I'm so excited about this, the Psygnosis reunion.
I'm going to be wearing my Psygnosis t-shirt on this one because it's just so good. And, you know, we've got Mike Clark there and he kind of went in as a young boy and then came out a man.
Was he like a YTS scheme or something?
He was really young when he joined. And the whole period of Psygnosis, they kind of started with the Amiga and then they came out with the PlayStation at the end. It was like Wipeout and, you know, giant titles like that.
Well, they got absorbed by Sony, didn't they?
Yeah, and G-Please, do you remember that one?
Oh, mate,
the kind of flying one, yeah.
Colony Wars as well. And I mean, even going back to the Amiga, Lemmings, Shadow of the Beast games as well.
Yeah.
So this is, when do you ever get all these guys together in a room talking about those days?
No, it's crazy.
And there's going to be plenty more as well. We've got coders, musicians, graphic artists. So.
Well, there's another thing going on, which is kind of GoldenEye's anniversary, isn't it?
I can't believe that GoldenEye's 20 years old this year.
It's absolutely mad. And, you know, David Doak's going to be there from Rare, and we've had him on, and also Paul Jury, who's like one of our good friends from Retro Gamer.
Well, this is going to be the N64 GoldenEye 20th anniversary panel, so obviously you get the story of the creation of the game. David and the guys are going to be there. I've also heard there's going to be a chance to maybe challenge them.
Oh, Golden Gun, that would be great, yeah.
If they lose, that's going to be some egg on their face, isn't
so
it?
So embarrassing, and they're probably... You know, they skinned a lot of the staff into GoldenEye. So you could probably play Dr. Doak.
Yeah, and beat him in the game. Yeah. And then on the Sunday, if you love the Spectrum, there is a massive Spectrum talk. I love the name, Specky Sunday.
Oh, that's a great name, yeah.
Well, there is this new movie coming out, Memoirs of a Spectrum Addict. Jim Bagley's going to be on stage. I mean, you couldn't have a Spectrum panel without Bagley.
No, and you could have any talk about the Spectrum next as well without Jim Bagley.
And you're going to get to see a little glimpse of this movie as well. So if you love the Spectrum, do not miss this. And we're in talks to get a few more panels organised as well that we'll let you know about over the next couple of weeks. But seriously, if you love retro gaming, this is the biggest retro gaming event every year in the UK. And it happens on the weekend of October 14th and 15th in Manchester at Event City. And if you can't make it down, I mean, we do have listeners all around the world. We'll obviously be recording the talks for YouTube.
Yeah, putting it on YouTube and everything. We're awful at recording stuff usually, so we're going to have 20 microphones everywhere just to catch it.
We can't not record this one.
No.
But what's even better than listening to it on YouTube or the show is coming along and checking it out in person because, I mean, essentially this is the Retro Hour Live, isn't
it? Yeah, yeah.
So should we give away some weekend passes?
Oh, totally, yeah. How are we going to do it? We're going to do a comp or just... pull it out of the hat.
I reckon we make this as easy as possible. So what you've got to do, if you'd like to win a pair of weekend passes, that's you and a friend, can come along. You can get them for free on the Saturday and the Sunday. You get to check out all the talks.
All the games for free, yeah.
Absolutely. Have a night out in Manchester afterwards as well. So
the Arcade Club, that's always a good place to go afterwards.
Plenty of stuff to do in Manchester. So if you want to come along, here's what you've got to do. Nip onto our website, theretrohour.com. Fill in the form that you'll find there on the front page. We're not going to set a question. Let's make this dead easy. Drop your details in there. Get all your friends to do it as well. Then what we're going to do, we're going to keep this open for a fortnight. We'll close it at midnight on October 6th. So 2 weeks today at the time the show comes out. And then we'll pick out four winners. And you will each win a pair of weekend passes to come along for free to play Expo in Manchester.
You're lucky, guys.
Can't say fairer than that, can we?
No.
So check it out right now. All the terms and conditions you'll find and the form to enter that on our website, theretrohour.com. Now, before we mention this week's very special guest, we want to say thank you so much to the people who allow us to do the show every week, to do events like Play Expo in Manchester, and just keep doing the Retro Hour. I mean, we're getting towards our second birthday on the show now.
It's crazy. And, you know, we've had a few comments about how the quality of guests has been absolutely amazing. Well, we're just going to keep doing that and keep bringing you fantastic guys. And it's all thanks to your donations and help that we can do it.
Absolutely. So thank you so much this week, making donations to the Retro Hour podcast and making the Hall of Fame, Graeme Thompson,
Brenda Stones,
Damian Page,
and Dan Ryan,
who all made donations this week. Thank you so much, guys. If you'd like to do the same, we've got a little tip jar that you'll find on the front page of our website, either via PayPal or Bitcoin at theretrohour.com. Oh, we've got that much going on. We haven't even mentioned the guest yet. And to be fair...
Oh, my God. And this guest as well, Dan. It's fantastic. And, you know, we had Ian Livingston last week, and he's just an amazing founder of a company. But also, we've got Ian Stewart this week, another Ian. But he's the founder of Gremlin. And these were a massive European games house. You know, they published Monty on the Run on the C64, Alvida Zen Monte, if you remember that as well. Lotus, Zool, Supercars.
I used to love the Lotus games, and Zool as well, Zool 1 and 2 on the Amiga.
That's the kind of sound.
Something like that.
Yeah.
So he's going to be our special guest talking about those amazing games. Some really good memories. I mean, you know, if you kind of were like us and you played all those games back in the day on the C64 and the Amiga, do not miss this. Ian Stewart, founder of Gremlin, is coming up on the Retro Hour podcast in around 15 minutes from now. Now, some very interesting news this week. You know, last week we were talking all about, Zap 64 and Commodore Format. You know, we've been talking about magazines and that recently.
Yeah.
I don't know if you spotted this, and I've got to say a huge thank you to our good friend Warren, who works at Future Publishing, who kindly provided us with a couple of copies of this. Super Play magazine is back.
Oh, now I never knew about Superplay because I assume it was one of those kind of Nintendo magazines, because the only one I ever heard about was Nintendo Power, because Dave Perry would go on Games Master.
Yeah.
They'd always be Dave Perry of Nintendo Power. But did you know much about Superplay?
Well, I said my friend Martin used to buy it because he was a big like Super Nintendo fan back in the day, and it was by Future Publishing.
Okay.
It ran from 1992 to 1996. British magazine. There was actually, I think it was 47 issues they made back in the day. And the magazine stopped, obviously, when the Super Nintendo started winding down in 1996. But now, over 20 years later, you can finally get your hands on issue number 48.
Ah, so they've continued it from the run. Oh, yeah. That's really cool.
And what's amazing is, I mean, this is included for free in the current issue of Retro Gamer magazine.
I just bought the last one as well. I should try and get the next one.
Well, you've got a copy anyway, right?
Yeah.
Warren sorted us out with a couple. So if you go out and get issue number 172 of Retro Gamer, you'll find inside a very special one-off edition of Superplay. Now, the reason they brought it back is obviously with the SNES Mini coming out.
Ah, okay, yeah, nice little tie-in there.
And what they've done, though, is actually they've got a lot of the original team together, the original writers, and they've even got the original guy who used to do all the artwork and everything. So it looks like... I mean, I got this in the post of Warren, and before I read his note, I was like, what, has he sent me some like, old magazines that they used to do? Even the paper quality and everything, art and the articles, it actually looks like it could have been like made in 1994.
That's the great thing about Future Publishing. They seem to be kind of bang on with getting the accuracy. You know, if someone was going to go, oh, the new NES is out, we're going to release a magazine at the moment, you know, they may not do it to that high quality,
yeah,
but... getting the original writers in, geez, that's real dedication.
Well, you can tell, I mean, they've got Will Overton, who used to do all the artwork for the original 47 issues, and he's done the Star Fox 2 on the front of this.
Yeah.
But even like the layout and everything. And it's funny, you open it up inside, and it's like, you know, next issue will be out, and it says, don't know, maybe tries in 2047. That's very funny. But it's, you know, just the fact that an amazing magazine from back in the day is back for a continuation, which is like just nuts, isn't it?
Yeah, that's really cool. And I bet the fans are through the roof with that.
Oh, dude, it's just, you think of other magazines you'd love to see back, maybe like, you know, Amiga Format one day or Mean Machines or something.
Yeah, there's quite a few.
Yeah, so, I mean, do not miss this if you love, you know, those old mags. Even for someone who maybe wasn't even into the Super Nintendo that much, it's just a really nostalgic read. And Retro Game is a good read in itself anyway every month, isn't it? So look out for that in your local newsagents right now. Now, speaking of Nintendo, we obviously mentioned the SNES Mini there. You know, last year, everybody was trying to get their hands on a NES Mini.
Feverish, wasn't it? And they kind of, I remember all the prices on eBay just going through the roof and kind of people buying them up, pre-ordering them and then hoarding them. That was the kind of way that they went.
And scalpers.
Yes.
Yeah, who were like, you know, trying to rip people off on eBay. I remember him going into like CEX.
Yeah.
And I think they were selling them for about 120 quid, 130 quid.
135, yeah. I remember seeing them put up for that much. And I was thinking, really?
Yeah. If you don't want to pay that much money for it, good news is Nintendo have now realised that there is a big demand for this. And I don't think anyone saw this coming. They're actually going to be bringing out the NES Mini again in 2018.
Oh, wow. Because I heard a lot of people say, oh, this is the only run. And they've done this deliberately, a small amount of stock just to make it a rare item or something. But they've probably gone, oh, maybe we could get a bit more out of that.
Yeah. You know? Why don't Nintendo have the money rather than some eBay scalpers?
Yeah.
I'm looking at Twitter here as well. I mean, they haven't given many details. It was a tweet that came out on 12th of September. Said, we'll also be bringing back the classic Nintendo NES Mini back to Europe next summer. More information will be shared in the future. And they put a picture of it up. The top retweeted tweet after that is, it's as if hundreds of scalpers on eBay suddenly cried out in terror and were suddenly silenced. I feel like something lovely has happened. So there you go. If you want to get your hands on one. It's cool because obviously they're bringing out the SNES Mini.
Yeah.
Now the NES Mini is going to be alongside it. Probably the N64 Mini next year, let's be honest.
The full range, Mini everything.
So we'll keep you up to date on that as we hear more. Now obviously the Spectrum is kind of going through a huge revival at the moment. We mentioned this talk that's going to be happening at Play Expo. And there is actually another event coming up. It's called Spectrum 35. Now this is to celebrate 35 years of the ZX Spectrum. 35 years since it originally came out, and it's going to be held at, I mean, we've had these guys on the show before, the Centre for Computing History in Cambridge.
Ooh, interesting. There maybe a Clive might walk by, you never know.
Well, guess who's going to be there? Jim Bagley. Of course, Jim's going to be there.
Jonathan Cordwell as well. He's been on the show. He's a really good guy.
The Oliver Twins.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic.
They're going to be there too. Rick Dickinson is going to be there too. He's
Jared Bentley
designer.
As well. Yeah.
You know, if you love the Spectrum, I mean, this is again, you know, you're pretty much spoiled for choice if you're a Spectrum fan at the moment. And this is coming up on Saturday, the 28th of October. So it's only a couple of weeks away. Held in Cambridge, starts at 10 a.m. So we'll put all the details for that on our show notes at theretrohour.com. You love trackers, don't you?
I absolutely love trackers, yeah.
What's your favourite tracker?
Ooh, that's a nice question. I would say Optimed Sound Studio, even though a lot of people don't like it because it had extra features in. But yeah, it's just the one I use the most, so I'm the most used to it.
Was that the one where you could have like 16 channels or something?
Yeah, you could slow down half the tempo and then have like, yeah, ridiculous amounts. And it had a built-in synthesizer and editor, yeah.
Now, obviously, you can run like those old trackers, like, you know, Pro Tracker and Noise Tracker and all them things, yeah, in emulation. But maybe there are a lot of people that might want to make, you know, these kind of like C64 and NES and Amiga-style chiptunes on a modern machine.
Okay.
Well, there is now a new tracker.
Ooh.
That's just been released called Kleistrack.
Kleistrack, because I know there was this OpenMD thing, which was another tracker, but this looks really cool. This looks very much of the Pro Tracker ilk, like the fonts of it and the look. Oh, yeah, very nice.
I should put a few little clips of the music that's been made in it. Skip forward a bit.
Yeah, you see, now this is a more kind of traditional tracker. So there's like two wields of tracker. Yeah. You have one where it's the original samples and the original kind of synths, and then you have sampled trackers, where you've got all your 8-bit samples. This sounds a lot more like you're using the original kind of SID chip.
Yeah, well, I mean, it does load samples as well by the looks of it, yeah. But I think it's, yeah, it's very much synth-based, isn't it, by the sounds of it, yeah. But it does sound like a SID chip.
It's very nice.
Yeah, so if you want to download that, it's completely free, and it's available for Windows, and they're doing like a Linux version of it as well, I think.
Oh, nice.
So I'll put that link in our show notes as well. So it's like, it's just cool because that style of music's coming back big style now, isn't it?
Totally. Like, I'm going to an event, the Digital Music Fest.
Another event.
Another event, yeah. This is the Digital Music Festival, which is on the 30th of September. This is at the Retro Computer Museum in Leicester. And it's going to be cool. They're going to have kind of, you know, C64 audio will be there. There's going to be loads of people DJing and mixing and playing about. So pop along if you want.
Absolutely. So we'll put all that in our events calendar that's getting rather packed at the moment
getting
on our website, isn't
up.
It?
Yeah, we're not going to have any time to do the show, Dan. We'll just be on road constantly. You know what we need? We need a tour bus. or Robin Reliant. A retro Robin Reliant.
Got to be, or a DeLorean or something.
Yeah, yeah. It's powered by a C64 that keeps crashing. I think you have to reset it.
Robin Reliant's a bit more British, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So if anyone wants to donate one to the
Sinclair C5.
Trip behind you. Beep, beep.
The battery, I've got to charge it.
So thank you for checking out episode number 89 of the Retro Hour podcast. Check out all the events calendar on our website and download the show again next week from theretrohour.com. Right then, let's talk about those classic games. The Monty series, Lotus, Zool, Supercars. Our special guest this week is Ian Stewart, the founder of Gremlin. And we'll see you next week.
Ciao.
You're listening to the Retro Hour podcast, and it is time to welcome on this week's very special guest. Thank you for joining us, Ian Stewart. Welcome to the show.
Great to be with you.
Now, I'm sure we're going to get some really interesting stories about your time at Gremlin and games like Lotus and Zool and all these classics that Ravi and I grew up playing. But I thought it might be quite interesting to just kind of go back to day one. This is a question that we always like to ask just to get the grey matter working a little bit. What was your first ever computer experience then? Do you remember when you first saw like computers or a game?
I think my first experience was when I was working in Leskies, and we opened an in-store unit called Micro Digital, and all of a sudden we were asked to be selling things like Apple II computers and Sharp MZ80Ks and further to that Spectrums and Commodores, etc. So that was when it was really introduced to me. In truth, I only knew about computers prior to that, about going into this rather large room with lots of very large tape machines whirring around and being operated by punch card operators.
Well, what was the first computer that you actually owned, like your first home computer?
Crikey. What was my first? It was probably an Amstrad word processor.
Like one of those IBM clones or one of these?
The PWC or something, I think it was called.
Yeah, they ran WordStar. I remember that was the older big processor, wasn't it?
Mr. Sugar's first foray into endeavouring to eke pounds out of the computer market.
Some of those machines were right, the Amstrad ones as well. I remember like the CPC range and those machines. Actually, yeah, they're pretty decent home computers, weren't they, back then?
Well, they were. I suppose realistically, there wasn't a fantastic amount of competition around at that time. You know, their main competitor was the Spectrum, which, if you put the two side by side, you'd have probably gone for the CPC.
Well, you know, you mentioned the computer shop then. That was based in Sheffield, wasn't it?
That was after I left Laskers, and I opened a retailer's called Just Micro.
So why Sheffield then? Because your accent doesn't sound like you're from that area.
No, I'm from Surrey. Mm-hmm. I served an engineering apprenticeship in Surrey and decided that I didn't like the smell of oil and coming home filthy dirty every night, so I had a change of career, and that career took me to Northampton, and then from Northampton to Sheffield with Laskers. That was where we sort of started. I'd recognised when I worked at Laskers there was an opportunity to sell software, which a lot of the high street people weren't doing. So I decided to give up my area manager's job and throw my ball into the ring as far as starting off my own business. That was how Just Micro came about, and it was a very, very popular place in Sheffield. At weekends, it used to get heaving. It was horrible in there. It was only a tiny shop, and when you get 100 smelly youths in there, it was quite unpleasant, quite unpleasant at times.
It must have been exciting as well, though.
Oh, it was, because it was the start of everything, really. And that's, you know, from that point on, you know, we used to have regulars coming in and bringing in their own little programs they'd written, etc.
Well, you started a small team in Sheffield because people were kind of displaying graphics on the computers, and you thought, oh, this is interesting.
Yeah, but it was. It wasn't only that. I'd seen an opportunity. Imagine Software was started up in Liverpool. And I knew the guys that started it up, and I was seeing how successful they were becoming. I thought, well, you know, there's got to be an opportunity there as well. So we started looking for people. And obviously, because we had the shop there on our doorstep, so we embraced them, and that was how things got started as far as Gremlin was concerned.
So what were those like initial early days like at Gremlin then? What kind of culture did you have?
Oh, it was very relaxed. In truth, you know, at that point in the marketplace, you're making the rules up yourself. You know, there are no rules to follow. There are only a certain number of games out on the market, so you're looking at the competition and you're seeing where you can take it from there. It was exciting times, and obviously you've got young programmers working on processors that didn't have an awful lot of power. They really did do a great job of squeezing a lot out of those processes.
Why the name Gremlin Graphics?
I have no idea. It came about. We were looking for a name, and we'd spotted this Gremlin character in, and I can't remember where it was, but we just adopted it, and it sort of went on from there, really.
It all struck me that you didn't actually do a game based around a gremlin, did you?
No, it just never happened. You know, strangely enough, I don't think we ever talked about it either.
Okay, a bit too obvious, maybe, wouldn't it?
And if it had been a flop, then you know it wouldn't have stood the company in a very good position, really.
Well, you started on the 8-bits and Speccy and C64, kind of with games like Monty Mole, which was a fantastic game. It had a great British style of humour and kind of humbleness. Were you aiming for that?
Yes. Well, being from Sheffield, the story behind that product, it was created by Pete Harrop, whose father was a miner, and it was at the time of the miners' strike. It was one of those situations where we just start putting two and two together, and we were coming up with four, and Arthur Scargill ended up going in the game, and you had to topple Arthur Scargill by collecting ballot papers. So it gave us an opportunity. It gave us a real opportunity locally of gaining some coverage. And in the end, I think we ended up with about 11 minutes of prime news time, even and Trev McDonald, and finally you made One Night, which is a claim to fame for Monty Mole.
I mean, you actually used Monty in quite a few games. It was the, you know, the trilogy, really. Monty on the Run, Alfuize, Monty as well. I mean, did you expect to be using him so much? He kind of became like an early kind of British video game mascot, really.
It did, yeah. But obviously, at that time, it was all, you know, the whole thing was fairly new to us all. So it was a case, well, if something's successful, then we'll stick with it and we'll have another go. And that was the attitude. But you know, as time moved on, you then realised that you did actually have the opportunity of creating characters, creating brands, etc.
Well, the music, especially on the last two, is kind of famous worldwide, and that was by Rob Hubbard. How did you guys meet and start working together?
I'm pretty sure that we'd have heard some of Rob's stuff previously and got in touch with him. I seem to remember I remember him coming up to Sheffield and us looking at the projects, etc., talking about them. And, yeah, we worked with Rob on a number of projects, and he was the best out there at the time, without a doubt.
I mean, even to this day, Rob is still generally regarded as, like, you know, probably the most talented Commodore 64 musician. I mean, did he kind of spot that early on, did you, his talent?
Yes, without a doubt. Without a doubt. He was our turn to musician in the early days of the Commodore 64.
Well, Thing on a Spring was quite an innovative game, and that showed a lot of kind of advancements that were made in 8-bit gaming around that time, with physics and that kind of thing involved in it. I mean, did you enjoy that title, and was it quite a tough project to work on?
No, it wasn't a tough project. I was working with Jason Perkins, and mm-hmm. Jason's a really easy guy to work with. And it was a great game. It was one of my favourite games in the early days. I think it was because I could play it. Or at least I thought I could. When I watched the kids playing it, then it sort of put me in my place, really. But I liked the character, and I liked the game, and it proved one of our best Commodore 64 games.
Well, actually, you made an interesting point there. I mean, were you much of a games player yourself?
In all honesty, no. I was more on the business side. I came from a number of years with Laskers, but I come from a management background, so. I got involved in the games and I got involved in the characters, but I couldn't say I was a games player.
Well, in 1990, Impossible came around, and that was fantastic with the soundtrack by Barry Leitch, but it was a bit of a different style of platforming than Monty. What was the reaction like to the game at this time?
Not particularly positive. I think people didn't really understand why we'd taken it to that stage as far as the development of the character was concerned. Didn't work particularly well. Yeah, not Monty's sort of most glorious moment, really.
I mean, were there any titles around that time in, like, you know, the 8-bit kind of days that kind of progressed and maybe got shelved because they weren't working due to limitations of the technology, or any titles that just didn't make it out the door very often?
There were, yeah. The titles used to get canned for various reasons, whether it just wasn't working as far as the game was concerned, or there was an issue with the subject matter, or it was a case of, you know, if it really didn't work, then you shouldn't really put it out there. And, you know, we did canned projects. You know, you look back on it sometimes, you think, well, you know, we could have canned it earlier or whatever, but Beaver Bobbing Damn Trouble didn't make it out, which has been written by Christian Urquhart. It just wasn't going anywhere as far as the product was concerned. It wasn't particularly a reflection on Christian, it just wasn't going anywhere as far as the game. We got stuck on that one. And that happens. You know, you have a concept, you try again, and then again, if it doesn't work, then you've got to be brave enough to say, right, let's not move ahead with this one.
So at what point did you guys decide to enter the kind of 16-bit market and also rebrand as a Gremlin Interactive?
Well, the 16-bit market, it was forced upon you because the market was changing. So the sales on the 8-bit products were diminishing. Obviously, with the 16-bit market getting a lot of support out there from Atari and Commodore. Used to enjoy going down to Commodore. We probably had a closer relationship with Commodore than we did Atari. It was always a fight to try and get your products included in the packs. Ocean always did a fantastic job of doing that. They had obviously licenses that they were attaching to their products at that time, which gave them an advantage, but we managed to get Zool in the pack.
Well, there's one Amiga and ST game that I remember everybody had, you know, regardless of being in the pack or not, because it was that good, was Lotus Esprit Turbo. And, you know, the speed in that game, it was like, it was a revolutionary title at the time. How did you get the Lotus tie-in, and what did they make of the game when you showed it to them?
The product came from Magnetic Fields, and they approached us with a racing game. And at that time, I think it was when attaching licenses to products was just becoming popular. And we wanted the product to stand out from the others. It was a case of going over to Norwich to see the Lotus people and see their marketing people, show them what we've got. And, you know, they took the bait, and, you know, we managed to close a deal as far as the license was concerned. And it was one of the best tie-ups we've ever had.
I know before that, Outrun kind of had like a Ferrari in there, but it was never branded as like a Ferrari game. I mean, I imagine getting such a big kind of prestigious company, was that quite an expensive license?
No, more expensive than other licenses out there. It was in the ballpark of single digit percentages, and you know, moderate guarantees, nothing outrageous. They were really pleased to see the product out there with their cars featured.
I mean, I remember every kid at school, it's like, when we grow up, we're going to buy a Lotus. So, you know, that was always a dream after playing those games.
They're probably a bit quieter than they were. They had some great cars. We had some great track days with them.
I bet, yeah.
Well, the music was just fantastic. Like, even if I put it on in my car at the moment, I'd probably start speeding because it's just so good.
That is a problem. You have to be careful.
I remember when, the second game, I think Lotus 2, the series really got into its stride then, and that, you know, fans generally considered that the best, you know, from what I see these days. How did kind of getting a follow-up to that game, what were you kind of thinking in the second game? What was the thought behind improving the original?
It's always a case of endeavouring to add more features into the products, looking at the car handling, etc., the types of surfaces you're driving on, and the terrain, etc. And I think we did a pretty good job at giving the consumer a really varied type of game as far as racing was concerned. And it was a case of building on the first one. I think it was more icing on the cake than anything else.
Well, I remember one amazing feature about that is you could actually link up, like, two Amigas. You know, it was kind of like early...
Or an Amiga and an ST as well.
Yeah, early online gaming.
No, that was one of the features. It was something that... I'm not sure what product we'd identified that had come up in that we thought, you know, this should work on Lotus. I'm not sure how many people played it in that way, but it was a good feature to have in there. It's not a selling point at the end of the day.
What was the thinking of the third one? Because it was a lot more advanced, you know, graphically, but it didn't seem to get as high praise as the second.
I think the issue you've got there is you didn't really have any more processing power. Although programmers were getting smarter as far as how they tweaked the processors and got smoother running graphics, etc., there wasn't a great deal more that we could do with the game. You know, I think maybe we should have stopped at two and not bothered doing the three. But hey ho, you know, there were other products that were coming through as competing at that time. It got very, very competitive at that time as well, as far as product were concerned.
Well, another great racing game that you guys made was Supercars, and it kind of spun off a whole genre of above view, like mini racing games on the Amiga. There was tons of clones of Supercars, I remember.
And that was another Magnetic Fields product. Now, we had a working relationship with Magnetic Fields, and we worked really well together. Supercars was one of those that, you know, again, really, really appealed. Lots of features, great fun to play.
Well, the second game, I mean, Supercars 2, that was lots of fun. It introduced stuff like a multiplayer and extra weapons and graphics and sound. I mean, I imagine did that get played a lot in the Gremlin office? I imagine that title
probably too much. It was one of those lunch breaks that overspilled into mid afternoon. We had plenty of testing. Let's put it that way. But it was one of the favourite games in the office, without a doubt.
It's a crack the whip and like do some work.
Yeah, but you know, Gremlin was always a reasonably relaxed place to work because people knew that the job had to get done. You know, if they took longer over their lunch, then, you know, they tended to work later into the evening. So it was give and take as far as that was concerned.
Well, another amazing title was Top Gear, and it's still, like, number one Mega Drive game in Brazil. Like, Barry Leach will go over to Brazil and perform massive concerts to all of the guys, and they'll all be doing Top Gear themes on their guitars. It's crazy.
Yeah, Top Gear really spun out of the Lotus game. We were working with a Japanese company called Kemco. They wanted a different branding on the game. Yeah, it was the name that they chose to actually go on that product. Top Gear was popular, not for any reason that it was a BBC television program. So I don't think it was very popular at that time. But it was quite big in Japan as well.
Well, obviously, when we got into that era, I mean, you know, when Sonic the Hedgehog came out and we had Mario before that, in the 16-bit era, there was kind of a war of the mascots, and then Zool came around. So what was the thinking of Zool? Was that the need to have a mascot?
Well, that was our intention. I leave it for others to decide as to how successful we were, really. It's my favourite character of my whole sort of Gremlin career. Yeah, he's quite dear to my heart. Anyone listening out there that wants to do a Zool game, get in touch with me.
Oh, please do. I'd love to see Zool getting updated.
I would as well. I would as well. I would relish that. There's lots of retro products coming out there, and I think there could be a really good Zool game produced now.
Zoolmania could be the one.
Zoolmania. One of your questions was what you've changed in the character, if I remember right. I'm here looking down that list.
Yeah.
I think the one thing I would have changed was I'd have given him a mouth.
Well, I was wondering, where did the design of Zool come from then? What was he originally meant to be? What was, like, the concept?
He was an alien ninja from the nth dimension. You need to read the inlay.
But I remember all the magazines would call him an ant, and I'm like, he was not
no,
meant to
an ant. No, never an ant. Yeah. Never an ant. An ant has got more than four legs.
That game was so impressive graphically for the Amiga. You know, it was far beyond a lot of games that were out at the time, platformers. Did it take a lot of resources and kind of effort to get that out?
It took a lot of effort from a small number of people. Yeah, Aid Carlis was the lead designer on it. I worked with Aid on the character, etc., and spent many hours sat down looking at how we, the types of levels we designed, etc., and what the character can do, what he can't do. And it was a case of designing the game around what the character could do and what we made him do at the end of the day.
Well, everyone at school, like, loved that game. All the kids that had Amigas, and, like, we just, after school, we played for hours and hours. And I remember a lot of the magazines kind of got behind Zool, as, like, they called him, like, you know, the Sonic the Hedgehog killer, didn't they? I mean, did you kind of like that hype, and how did you feel about it?
Yeah, well, we had a T-shirt, which, I don't know if you've seen it, Bad News for Hedgehogs.
Yes, I do remember that.
With Zool smashing through the screen, yeah. No, we played on that as much as we could. We obviously didn't have the marketing clout that Sega had for Sonic, and you can't, you know, going up against the types of teams they must have had creating the Sonic product. That was a tough ask, but I thought we did a really good job.
Well, something that's quite interesting, because a lot of people do remember it as an Amiga title, but it did come out on the Mega Drive as well, didn't it? So did Sega have anything to say about that?
No, not at all. Mm. No, I still think it's most successful platform was the Amiga by far. I think the Mega Drive users scoffed at the Amiga character.
Well, I remember there was an arcade machine as well, wasn't there, that never got released, did it? Or
I think some went out, but it was one of those times when some of the arcade manufacturers in the UK were trying to create their own product, etc. It was an experience going through that process and seeing what else we could do with it, as far as, because it's a different, very different question about asking someone to continually put coins into a machine than it is asking them to play a video game. So you have to design the game somewhat differently. Otherwise, one person could be on it all day long.
Well, Zool 2 was a great kind of improvement, added extra character and upgraded graphics, but the issue at the time was a kind of a meager market that was dwindling. What point did you decide to kind of leave the Amiga market?
Yeah, it was one of the hardest decisions we had to make, because we loved working on the machine. The market tells you when you're not achieving the sales on a product, you know, you have to step aside then and look at the other platforms. which is basically what we did, and it was PlayStation that we looked at from that point.
So you know, Zil 2 came out and it was like CD32 and the Atari Jaguar as well, didn't it?
It did, yeah. We put it on everything we possibly could.
Well, another unique title was Little Devil, which the animation was so accurate. It was kind of like Earthworm Jim later on. You know, it had that motion capture or animation capture. What was the process behind getting this all done?
That product was produced in Dublin by Gremlin Ireland. We'd acquired a small business over there, a group of guys. And I don't know if you remember the Don Bluth Studios. Some of these guys have been animators there. And if you look at the sort of Don Bluth graphics, you recognise the skills that they then applied to the Little Devil character.
Well, the whole kind of package for Little Devil was fantastic. I even remember on the CD32 getting stuff like newspapers and all these items included in the box. It really felt like a kind of a complete massive game, that did.
Yeah, it was a real fun product to work on, and I loved the character. He was the real deal as far as I was concerned. He had attitude, you know, and he was funny as well. Wasn't massively successful, but he got some very, very good coverage, and it was great to work on, as I say.
I imagine just because of, like, you know, the platforms that it was out on, like the CDI and the CD32, didn't have a massive user base, it turned out, did it? So that probably went against you.
No, we were at the back end of that market, really. Mm. Always difficult.
Well, one later game that, you know, we'd like to touch on is the fabulous Normality, that which was, you know, a pretty crazy concept, but... It worked, didn't it?
Well, I think it did. I'm not sure that the public did.
No, I thought it fit into that kind of 90s grunge kind of period. And Violet Berlin was in it, wasn't she? From
Yeah, it was one of the first products that we'd started using motion capture on. And I thought it really worked. I thought it was humorous. It was graphically good. You know what? With products like that, sometimes it's all about timing. Yeah, although the game did okay, it never sold that well or got the accolades I thought it was due.
And it was a difficult time, wasn't it? It was kind of that in that kind of mid-90s era. You know, so much changed, didn't it, around then in terms of technology?
Well, so much changed, and it was very competitive as well. Yeah, and even getting products onto the shelf in stores was getting difficult. You couldn't guarantee that just because you were publishing a product that the retailers would take it.
I mean, in terms of, like, you know, your franchises, like Zool, for example, was there any plans to ever put that on, like, the PlayStation?
But if I'd had my way, it would have gone onto the PlayStation, but I didn't always get my way. Let's put it that way. So it never made it. But there's time yet.
Well, one thing I wanted to mention about Zool as well was the kind of sponsorship and how that deal came around.
Chupa Chups.
Yeah.
Yeah, or Shoopy Shoop, whichever way you want to say it. we're probably responsible for ruining more people's teeth in the video game industry than anybody else. We used to send out great big pots of those things to retailers and to distributors, etc. They loved us.
You used to get one in the box as well. Well, there's one in the box
for about
the
a year. Yeah. I don't think you'd be allowed to do that nowadays, actually.
That'd be a carrot or something now, wouldn't it? How did that deal come about, though? Because that was quite unusual for the time, having a sweet manufacturer getting a video game tie-in.
Yeah, it wasn't the first sweet manufacturer that we'd embraced. We embraced Chewix with a game called Muncher, which was a bit of a rip-off of Rampage, I think. But it was a case of trying to find something that would fit into the world of Zool, and you know, the colourful wrappers that Chupa Chups had, and their image was sort of spot on, really. And the two seemed to go well together. And it was then a case of getting in touch with the Spanish company initially, as far as the licence was concerned, and then dealing with the distributor over in the UK.
Was it kind of did they specify that there had to be like a certain amount of them in the game or logos or anything?
No, I don't remember there being any major issues. There was just a case that we needed to replicate their logos correctly. Yeah, nothing really more than that.
I think out of all the kind of sponsorship deals with the Amiga, that one fit the most because they had stuff like LucasAid on Super Frog and Quavers on other games, and it didn't seem to kind of mould, but Zool and Chupa Chups seemed to kind of work,
They just went together, didn't they? They really did. I'm sort of Yeah. No, I whenever I think about Zool, I automatically think about Chubba Chups anyway.
Well, it's a genius move because it's like, you know, to this day, that had more effect on, like, me than any TV advertising ever did. You know, I play it now and I want one, you know? It's like...
Yeah. You know, I think a number of years later, they were approached again by us and they weren't interested in doing anything else. But, hey, that's life.
More fool them.
They're lost, I say.
Well, one big purchase that you made in 1996, Gremlin purchased DMA. Which
we did.
Must have been exciting to get your hands on such a talented team and products.
David Jones, yeah.
How did that come about then?
Well, Gremlin at that time, it had gone through a few changes and it was being managed at that time by Jenny Richards, Stuart and myself. And we were looking at ways of building the company up and our idea was to take it public. And we needed to grow it fairly quickly and... We were looking for acquisitions, basically. We got to know Dave Jones, super guy, super talented, and a great team up in Dundee, really, really creative team. And they'd been working on the original, what's that, that game? I think it had a minor success, Grand Theft something.
Yeah, I may have heard of that one, GTA or something.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Well, obviously, that was going to be my next question. It's like, you know, did you know about Grand Theft Auto when you bought them and how come you let it get away?
Well, it was being developed for, actually, initially for Bertelsmann. And we had no say in it. They had a contract to produce, they'd sold the title to Bertelsmann, basically. And then subsequently, Bertelsmann then sold it to Take-Two. So I'm afraid I nearly got my sticky fingers on it, but not quite.
Oh, that must have stung a bit for a couple of years after, did it?
Well, you know, you just got to look at it and say, well, you know, DMA still produced a fantastic product. And, you know, they were the guys that planted the seeds for making Take-Two many, many, many millions of dollars.
Yeah.
I'm not bitter at all.
as long as somebody got the millions.
As long as someone did, yeah. And as long as lots of players out there enjoyed playing it. That was the main thing. But no, it was great. I really enjoyed going up there and spending time with those guys. They were so creative. And, you know, a good number of them spun out doing their own thing now, etc. And obviously you've got Rockstar that spun out from there. So they're still about. They're still doing good stuff, no doubt.
Well, what would you say is your favourite game from the whole kind of Gremlin era?
Well, it's difficult to say because my time with Gremlin changed so much over the years. Initially, I was getting involved in game testing, etc., and the characters and what have you. And then as the business grew, I was more about business development and I still took a great deal of interest in the character designs, etc., and... It's got to be Zool, hasn't it, really?
It's an iconic game, isn't it?
And my number plate is still S200L.
Oh, that's cool.
That's amazing.
and I've had that number plate for many years now.
Have you heard of the Zool beer as well that you can buy?
No.
I think a brew house brewed up one batch of Zool beer and the logo was just the eyes. And you could
really?
There and have a pint of... I'll try and track it down and tell you where it's available.
I miss that one. I suppose as well as Zool, like, you know, the other one that's closest to my heart, really, is Premier Manager. That's just... You know, that still sells today. Mm. You know, it's on PlayStation Store and I get a little royalty check every month, which I'm very happy for. And so you never know, you might see another Premier Manager game coming along sometime.
Well, we need to talk more about that in a second. That could be quite interesting. I was just wondering, though, before, you know, we kind of tie up this era, I mean, why did you leave Gremlin when Infogrames took it over then?
I had a massive heart attack and a quadruple bypass.
So time to end it then.
Yeah. That kind of slows you down.
just a minor issue. No, we just completed the sale to Infogrames and I was taking a break. And I took my young daughter, who was seven, took her skiing to meet some friends in Salt Lake. Mm-hmm. And, top of a mountain. That was interesting.
God.
But that's another story. So that was the reason why I stepped back from Gremlin at that time. And apart from that, Infogrames had had acquired the company. They'd made certain changes whilst I was off. They'd done some things that I wasn't particularly happy about. And if I'd gone back, it would have been to a different company.
They wound it down about 12 months later anyway, didn't they?
Yeah, unfortunately.
Obviously, there's been a couple of new books come out. There's Mark Hardest and Sam Dyer also released one. Have you seen a new interest in Gremlin?
Locally, yes. Yeah. Yeah, into the book launch and what have you. Yeah. No, it's nice. You know, the Gremlin is always, for me, it's always been there. If I still live in Sheffield and you meet people and you've just got such fond memories for products. And for, you know, even going back as far as Just Micro, you get people in their sort of 40s saying, oh, I used to come in your shop. I used to get told off because I was late for school or whatever, you know. Or they were playing hooky. We used to have to chuck them out, you know. It's never gone away. It's never gone away. And I don't think it will, for me, it will never go away anyway.
Well, you're involved in your company, Urban Scan. You actually got some of the rights to Gremlin Games. How did that happen?
Yeah, I bought quite a large tranche of the IPs from Infogrames. So I own Premier Managers, All Loaded, Realms of the Haunting, Normality, all those titles. The intellectual property is owned by me.
So are there any plans to do HD updates of any of the classics that you now own?
Well, I'd love to do some, but I'm not in a position to do them myself. I sort of step back from the industry somewhat now and I'm not as close to it as I used to be. You know, I'd be happy to talk to people who have got a serious interest.
So what needs to happen then if someone's listening to this and they're like, I could make a new Zool game on the PlayStation or Xbox?
Well, it depends who it is and how capable they are.
That needs to happen.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, it would need to be someone seriously who's got the finances to put in place to be able to do it. You know, it's okay, people are saying, oh, I can produce this game or I can produce that game. But, you know, to be competitive out in the marketplace now, you need a fair amount of muscle behind you. But there are players out there that I would imagine that would be interested.
Because it has been.
Maybe even some of the bigger ones, I don't know.
Well, I mean, you look recently, and Ravi and I were talking about this on the show last week. I mean, you know, Micro Machines game got, you know, updated and Crash Bandicoot's been number one on like the PlayStation. Yeah. So there is an interest in that era again now,
I fully appreciate that. I fully appreciate that. As always, it's a case of timing and me finding the time to do something about it.
Fingers crossed.
Yeah.
Well, what would you say was the most proud moment at Gremlin?
We won, from a Sheffield point of view, we won a few Business of the Year awards. One of them was presented by one of my heroes, which was Michael Heseltine. For me, that was one of my proudest moments. Mm-hmm. I was proud to grow the business and to float it on the London Stock Exchange. You know, we ended up with sort of 300 staff. That made me proud. It was, you know, building the business was a fantastic experience. And I think Gremlin was one of the parties in the UK that was a foundation for lots of really good things happening out there that are still happening today. Sumo Digital, for instance. A good bunch of the guys there used to work for Gremlin. Carl Cavers, Paul Porter and Darren have done a great job of turning Sumo into a fantastic studio.
Oh, they're great. We've actually got a Sumo Digital studio in Nottingham that's just opened up. So
that's right, yeah, that's right, by Paul Porter, yeah. They're very switched on guys. I'm proud to have been part of the fact that it was Gremlin that kicked that off, that, you know, gave those guys the opportunity.
Well, you know, it's a fantastic legacy, and Gremlin have got these amazing titles and these guys that came out of it and have gone on to do wonderful things afterwards as well. And, you know, for Ravi and I, getting a chance to talk to you and the games that we played as kids that we'll never forget. So it's just been wonderful talking to you, Ian. Thank you so much for doing that.
No, it's been a pleasure, and thanks for allowing me to drag up some of my, some people find really boring memories.
Not at all.
No, you gave us the opportunity to show off in the playground with all the Sonic fans, so that's great.
Yeah, and he's not an ant. An alien ninja.
A ninja, yeah.
Much cooler than an ant.
Absolutely. You know, you need to watch out. What's going to happen in the nth dimension going forward?
Oh,
and don't ask Donald Trump.
Wonderful. Thanks again for coming on then, Ian.
Take care. Cheers. Lovely to speak to you.